You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Forster is with us in the second block, right? Yeah, okay, great. I wanted to talk, welcome back from the weekend. It's amazing what happened in New York over the weekend. 300,000 to 400,000 people showed up for the climate march, which was spectacular. There is apparently another action today where people are going to be flooding Wall Street, and there is a stated intent to engage in civil disobedience, which would be presumably things like, you know, blocking traffic illegally and then getting arrested. And in fact, over at a couple of sites, I say Crooks and Liars and a few others, they're, you know, here's how to contribute to the bail fund. So we'll see how that plays out. That may be going on as we speak or later on in the day. I'm not frankly sure. A couple of, quick heads up, just things I wanted to mention. Sammy Youssef, for those of you in Washington, D.C., September 26th. Today is the 22nd, so that would be, Friday, I think? Yeah, I don't do calendars in my brain. Anyhow, 26th at 8 p.m. at the Strathmore, Sammy Youssef is going to be playing in North Bethesda. This concert benefits the Foundation for Traditional Studies, and it's pretty amazing. Strathmore.org is the website where you can learn more about that. And, yeah, it's this Friday. Thank you. And Jim Riva. My old friend Jim Riva has a new book out that he is giving away for free. Jim writes fiction, and it's just brilliant, funny, amazing fiction. He started giving this away on September 17th because that's the date in 1859 that San Francisco native Joshua Norton declared himself Emperor of the United States. And Jim's new book is called The City, A San Francisco Story, or Magic in the City, excuse me. And I've read it. It's a hoot. And you can get it for free over at jimriva.com, J-I-M-R-I-V-A.com. This is just a heads up. Jim is a friend, and it's a good book, and I thought you'd want to know about it. And nobody's making a penny on this, at least to the best of my knowledge. So there's that. But what I wanted to talk about in the context of the march this weekend, the march on New York, was Louise and I were here in Washington, D.C., and for a couple of reasons, but one of them was that long ago and far away when we worked out this publishing deal for Dan Sisson's new book, The American Revolution of 1800, we booked this Busboys and Poets event, which we did last night, and thanks to Shane and Danielle for showing up. And we had a nice small crowd. It was small enough that afterwards we were able to just sit and talk for a while, which was really, really sweet. But the thing that, from hanging out with Dan now for 5 days, and we spent some time with him and Karen, his wife, over the weekend. Dan lives in a replica of Monticello out in the woods in Washington State. He's a professor out there, and wrote the first edition of this book 40 years ago. The number one thing that I've learned that I learned when I first read his book, and then I promptly forgot, was the definition of faction. Now, we talked about this with Dan on the program last week, but this, I think, could be one of the most important things that we don't know that we don't know. Right? There's the stuff that you know you don't know, and there's the stuff that you know that you know, and there's the stuff that you don't know that you know. But the most destructive can be the stuff, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, the most destructive can be the stuff that you don't know that you don't know. And a lot of people who have any interest in the U.S. Constitution or American history, or took an American history class, or even just a history class in high school, probably read Federalist Number 10. Federalist Number 10, this was in 1787, November 22nd, 1787. James Madison was writing, I think under the name of Publius or something. Yeah, Publius. He was writing he and Hamilton and John Jay were writing these op-ed pieces that in total we call the Federalist Papers, that were basically sales pitches for the Constitution. And Madison figured out that there was a threat to our Democratic Republic. There was a genuine threat. And Federalist Number 10 is where he's asking the question, what can we do about this threat? And frankly, He does not answer that question. And the threat was something called faction. Now, most people think faction means political party or interest group. But it is actually a much more specific term. And in fact, here's what James Madison says in Federalist Number 10. By faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority, doesn't matter, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. So a faction is a group of people, and it might even be a majority, but a faction is a group of people who are looking out for themselves rather than looking out for the community. And the length and breadth of the understanding of at least the first five administrations in the United States, the Washington administration, the Adams administration. Adams actually got a little cozy with faction, which is why the election of 1800 is referred to as the Revolution of 1800, because Jefferson basically threw out the factions. The Jefferson administration, the Madison administration, and Monroe. These five people, these five presidents, understood this notion of faction and were quite emphatic about it. That faction is when you've got a group of people, they can be politicians or not, who are trying to influence public policy in a way that does not help the public good, but does help them. So the question, when ABC, CBS, NBC chose not to talk about the climate march in New York City on their Sunday morning shows, even though it was happening, well, 300,000 people in the streets, that's not the news. When, Joe Scarborough this morning on Joe Scar, or Morning Joe, whatever that's called, chose not to discuss the climate march in any consequential way. When the news media basically just chose to ignore this, the news media that takes millions, arguably probably hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even more than that, from the fossil fuel industry. You've seen these BP ads, BP, our commitment to America. You've seen these fracking ads. Yes, fracking is, safe and clean, and this is natural gas that's going to save America. And, down here in Florida, we got a factory that's half sunlight, half natural gas. You've seen all these ads, right? This is money to the networks. So here we have two groups. And I ask the simple question, which one is a faction? Because by the definitions of the founders of this republic, of the United States of America, the faction should be opposed by all of us with all our might and should be opposed by the government itself. Right? Again, once again, faction is a group of people who are interested in their own self-interest at the expense of the common good. Which is faction? Those 400,000 people or 300,000 plus who marched in New York City saying, clean up the environment, stop climate change, was that a faction? Or was it the Coke refineries, Coke Oil, ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, all these big oil companies who are are investing largely in media and who are buying think tanks and who are constantly trying to get the message out, there's no global warming, there's no, don't look behind that curtain. Pretty clear to me that the faction is the fossil fuel industry. And we are being badly served by our media in that they give the faction all the time they want, and they ignore the anti-faction group, which is all the rest of us, who are working specifically for the public good. I'm telling you, James Madison is rolling over in his grave right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this is one of the most important things that we have lost since the Reagan era. We don't even teach it in school anymore, is the difference between the public good and private good and how they're always at war with each other. Welcome back. Jerry watching Free Speech in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Jerry, thanks for watching DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, what's on my mind is what's pretty much on your mind, too. How did we get suckered into another war in the Middle East? And the simple answer is that Obama has been completely turned in the way of becoming a neocon. His administration has always been Republican, as his original appointments to the cabinet of Clinton, Geithner, Gates, and Holder, who have always had a loyalty toward the establishment. Hope and change died with his appointment into the first cabinet, and every one of these people has been converted by the neocons in Washington and in the entire country, and we are fighting wars for the sake of the neocon philosophy or theology, whatever you would call it. We have allied ourselves with the Saudi Arabians who attacked us at the World Trade Center on 9/11, and truly we should have turned and overthrown the entire Saudi royal family. In addition, we have allied ourselves to the Israelis, who have stabbed us in the back in every way with their settlement, which they announce whenever a Secretary of State lands at the airport, and have started ethnic cleansings and wars against the Palestinians, which we have been forced to support.
Yeah, Jerry, you've got a nice list of complaints here, and I can't find, frankly, a lot to disagree with other than maybe the adjectives that you're using. What's your solution?
My solution is, I wish I had a solution.
What's the value of complaining if you don't have a solution? I mean, I see a bunch of different pieces, moving pieces to this. Obama didn't decide that he was going to go after ISIS or, you know, the Islamic State, I guess, is now the new parlance. It didn't decide that he was going to go after them in a big way until public opinion hit like 65% in favor of going after them. You could argue the public opinion hit 65% in favor of going after them because of the way that the media sensationalized the beheadings, or because the way that the media brought all these old neocons back on TV, and we got all these generals and all these right wing idiots on, you know, who are double dipping with the defense industry. I don't think, you know, I get it, Jerry, that you want to personalize all this on Obama. I think that that's not only wrong, but simplistic. It ignores all the other stuff that's going on. You've got a permanent defense apparatus. You've got a system here in Washington, D.C., where Obama comes in and they say, yeah, you're here for 4 or 8 years. We're here for 40.
I do have a solution.
Okay, what is it?
My solution is to abandon the Sunnis, who have not been a nickel's worth of help to us, and to abandon the support, unchecked support of Israel, and start an alliance with the Shiites in Iran, who are basically a peaceful people.
I think that what we need to become is basically an honest broker in the region. We need to become Switzerland and not make any alliances and not pick anybody's side. That's my take. Jerry, thank you for the call. So let me just share with you, I think this is, is Jim Forrester with us? No, he's not? Okay. I think this is arguably one of the most important points in our democracy. One of the most important things that we as citizens need to learn how to do is to distinguish between what is faction and what is not faction. We need to revive this word, faction, first of all. It has been, you know, what happened was, you know, we had this word faction for the first, you know, 50, 80 years of the country, and then it kind of fell into disuse. And basically over the last 30 or 40 years, well, during the Nixon time and all the Nixon crimes and all that, you know, it was characterized as special interest groups. So the oil industry's special interest groups, or, you know, the Heritage Foundation or the Heartland Institute, you know, these right-wing think tanks funded by billionaires, they would come out and they say, yeah, we're a special interest group. You know, so is the So is the save the fill in the blank, right? So is Greenpeace. Greenpeace is a special interest group. But there's a very significant difference, and I think Americans intuitively know the difference, but we haven't explicitly made this difference clear in our media in at least 40 years. In fact, the last president, I think, to specifically talk about this was Dwight Eisenhower. And that is that there are people and organizations who are explicitly lobbying Congress, lobbying you and me, trying to influence public opinion and doing it successfully, buying legislators, buying judicial seats by virtue of, you know, helicopter drops of money into campaigns in order to advance their own personal interest at the expense of everybody else. That's faction. And we need to start calling these things out. This is faction. Faction is evil. James Madison, Federalist number 10. Let me read this to you. This is among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union. And see, he's selling the Constitution here. And it's a good thing we're going to do this. Among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union, none deserves to be more accurately developed. In other words, let's talk about this and be very clear about it. Then its tendency to break and control the violence of faction. In other words, this is one of the good things about a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, is that we can, by virtue of electing our representatives, we the people having the power, we can stop the violence of faction, the damage that faction does to a nation. He said, the friend of popular government never finds himself so much alarmed for their character and fate as when he contemplates their propensity to this dangerous vice. He's talking about Alec. He's talking about the Koch brothers. I mean, there's just the instability, injustice, and confusion introduced into the public councils, right, into our legislative bodies, have in truth been the mortal diseases under which popular governments have everywhere perished. And then he goes on to say, complaints are heard everywhere that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and the measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority, which he's calling faction. He said that prevailing and increasing distrust of public engagements and alarm for private rights. And this is exactly, you know, this is the whole libertarian thing. We don't need no stinking government. We don't need public engagements. We just need property rights for individuals. Let the billionaires run everything. Here's what James Madison said about that in Federalist 10. That prevailing and increasing distrust of public engagements and alarm for private rights, which are echoed from one end of the continent to the other, these must be chiefly, if not wholly, effects of the unsteadiness and injustice with which a factious spirit, in other words, a spirit of faction, has tainted our public administrations. He said, by a faction, what I mean is something that is adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. What we are seeing right now played out just writ huge. And we need to start asking the question, are you faction or not? What we're seeing played out right now is the battle of faction through ALEC to take over state legislatures, through all the lobbyists here in Washington, D.C. to take over the federal legislature, through Republicans being bought and sold by billionaires, and a few Democrats as well, typically more often by institutions than individual billionaires, but hey, it's happening. Always to the goal of, you know, let's cut the taxes of the billionaires. They try to pretend it's for the public interest. You know, they say, oh, you know, we can't have Obamacare because it's going to cause unemployment. Right. I mean, they always trot out some public interest as if to say, we're not faction. We're concerned about the public good. But it's a lie. And we need to recognize what is faction and what is a group working in the public interest.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We have a, and by the way, if you want to really dig into this, Dan Sisson's new book, The American Revolution of 1800, is the best. It's absolutely the best. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Forster is on the line, the executive vice president of DC 37, a member of Local 357. He's on the host committee for the People's Climate March and Labor Subcommittee, the lead organizer for DC 37 on this issue. He's a New York City public employee, a city research scientist at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, although he is not representing them. He's speaking about he's actually been the national co-chair of the Ask Me Green Caucus, and in 2008 was at the UN Global Warming Conference in Poland. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. What an event. I mean, the largest climate march ever in the history of the world. Absolutely incredible to be there, to be among all of those groups coming together, to be in the midst of labor having brought to come together on this. And, of course, so many environmental justice and faith organizations. I mean, it was quite an amazing event.
Wow. And what's going on today?
Well, there's, of course, as you, a lot of follow-up meetings. I just was at a meeting up at 32BJ and with a lot of labor people there to talk about, okay, where do we go from here? There are some other community actions here in New York City down on Wall Street. There was, of course, an announcement 2 days ago about some new environmental initiatives at the city level, and I think it was very important that the New York City Council and the mayor also marched with the parade and, of course, endorsed the parade as well to show we're really trying to move forward here all on the same page, and we're taking this issue very seriously, and, it, of course, it has to be taken seriously.
Yeah, yeah. What are your thoughts on how the media has covered this?
Well, I thought the generally, I mean, I can't speak for the media across the board. I mean, there's certainly I thought the New York Times did a good job. Front page, yeah. Good article, mentioned labor's participation rate at the beginning. I thought that
of course
was
it was in their hometown. I mean, but
yeah,
I, you know, watching
well,
watching
yeah,
the networks,
not exactly a small paper, but nevertheless,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, watching the big networks, I didn't see. Now maybe I missed something, but Media Matters is saying the same thing.
Yeah.
No live coverage of what was going on yesterday. Virtually no mention of it. No mention of it on the Sunday morning shows, which yeah. You know, this should have been front and center. These are all big networks that take millions and millions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry for advertising.
Yes.
And this morning on the so-called liberal network MSNBC, Joe Scarborough didn't even mention it apparently,
mm-hmm.
According to the folks over at DemocraticUnderground.com. I mean, it seems to me like. You know, we're looking at the power of faction, the power of the fossil fuel industry to try to basically not so much silence our media as keep them from speaking. I guess the effect is the same, but.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true, and I think we've seen this happen time and time again. I mean, one of the things that I think is like so positive coming off of this march is the ability to build really a huge coalitional movement, a whole new social movement, if you will, that could be akin to what we had back in the 60s with the, the civil rights movement, the women's right. movement, the anti-Vietnam movement. Those also, of course, did not get covered immediately, and I think that we cannot anticipate that everything is going to change just because we have one huge march in New York
City. But if this had been a Tea Party group and, yeah. and it had only been 3,000 people, yeah. it would have been covered by all the networks.
That's probably true. I think that there is a tendency towards not wanting to cover this, and I think part of our challenge is to go out there to do it again, to draw attention. But I think at the same time, it also speaks to the need for us to be working locally at the city and state levels.
Right.
That's going to be critical in terms of making real change on this issue. And obviously, this is something that needs action absolutely immediately. Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm with you. What is DC 37?
District Council 37 represents 120,000 municipal employees here in the city of New York and 50,000 retirees. A tremendous number of our members were impacted by Sandy, of course, 2 years ago. Our headquarters was flooded out for 8 months.
And, wow.
And I think that that has been a real wake-up call to the unions in general. And to us in particular on that. And I think it's a good prompter for us to now be joining forces with some of these other groups that have been involved with this for a while. This really is a union issue also.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. John Forster, thank you so much for dropping by. Thanks for the great work you're doing, and thanks for the update on what's going on.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And you can get more information at dc37.net. There's a link to it over on our website at tomhartman.com. Michael in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching and listening. What's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Michael.
I'm actually in Arizona right now, but I talked to you about four times before. I've been watching your show for 9 years, I believe.
Wow.
Anyway, I want to have lunch with you someday. But the reason I called is we have billions of miles of, maybe trillions of miles of sidewalks throughout the world. And I think if every activist carried some chalk, you know, sidewalk chalk, the big stuff, and we could write things like eliminate fossil fuels, go green, or beware mainstream media, or better yet, beware Fox News, et cetera.
That's a great idea. And there are many communities where you would be facing the possibility of arrest for defacing public property or vandalism or whatever. On the other hand, there may be some communities where this would be considered free speech. Since the tagging, the graffiti stuff of the 70s and 80s, it's gotten a lot harder to do even sidewalk chalk. But your point is well taken, and it's a good one. Michael, thank you for calling and sharing it. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Oh, I was just wondering. I remember when I was in ninth grade, I think it was, we took a class called Citizenship and Government, or, you know, something tied along those lines.
Right.
Basically civics, you know,
yeah.
How government works, how our vote works. Whatever happened to that?
I think a lot of it died with the Reagan administration. Suddenly civics became politicized. Civics classes, the civics classes that I saw when I was in school in the 60s and 70s, in the 50s and 60s, really, were argued that government had a positive role to play, that look at all the things that government has done. We talked about labor unions. We talked about the history of the five-hour work week. We talked about, you know, all these things. And then when Reagan came into office, we started hearing all, and these think tanks started up. They all started, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. The think tanks started cranking out all this information about how that's actually subversive, or that's communist, or that's collectivist, or that's, you know, whatever. And as a result, what used to be non-controversial civics stuff became controversial, and a lot of schools just said, screw it, we're not going to try and teach American politics, because no matter what we say, we get attacked, and so we're just going to teach science and math.
And my other shock was my son's South Carolina history class, state history class, South Carolina.
Right.
The teacher, I've discovered during a parent-teacher conference, had never heard of the Honeyer Path Massacre, which was when a National Guard shot down was called out to shoot down the striking textile workers, or the Orangeburg Massacre, which was, you know, when four SC State students were shot down by the Highway Patrol.
Right, and both took place in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we were living in Georgia in the northern suburban Atlanta for most of the childhood of our three kids. And two out of the three of them went through the Georgia public schools. And I was amazed that the civics class, I mean, they would come home from school and say, hey, did you know that the Civil War was actually the War of Northern Aggression? And that it was caused by the bankers in New York City, trying to screw the cotton growers down in the South. And I'm like, well, that's not what I learned in Michigan. So apparently civics is regional. But your point is well taken, Chris, and I think that we need to get back to teaching civics. But the problem is, I mean, Texas now, they're coming out with these new school book guidelines and just explicitly saying, you know, take out Thomas Jefferson, put in Rush Limbaugh. It's bizarre. Chris, thanks for the call. We do need to be teaching civics. Oneida in Maine. Hey, Oneida.
Hi. That man is just on his toes. I called because I have a granddaughter, and she's going into her third year now, junior year. And what I know that she knows, it just drives me up a wall. No, I should say what she doesn't know. When she can't name the three branches of government, when she can only name three or four presidents, when she has no idea about anything. She just learned about the Holocaust, And now one of her teachers is saying that the Holocaust, there was a Holocaust in another country just because it was ethnic cleansing. And there's no cursive writing anymore. They stopped teaching that.
Right.
There's a new math that they don't multiply like we were taught in our days. Now you make a little box with diagonal lines, and you scribble numbers in it, and you come out with a figure.
Right.
I can't understand it myself.
Yeah.
In the education that I had in the 50s, the mid-50s, I consider it was excellent. And I took one ACD test, and on a Saturday, we all just walked into school. We took the test, and no special anythings. I only asked for one college, a college in Iowa. I was accepted. I got my room and everything. I backed out because I got married. But she could never pass that test.
Mm-hmm.
And she is getting B's in her class.
Yeah. Yeah, we have been subjected largely since the era of William Bennett as the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan. We've been subjected to a series of basically experiments in education, many of them coming out of private corporations. I would suggest, well, not many, not most necessarily, but some of them are coming out of private foundations, the Gates Foundation, for example. I'm sure Bill and Melinda are very well-intentioned, but good grief. Our education system just has been ripped away.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is the power of faction again. These, you know, these people who want to privatize our schools so that they can make a buck on it rather than have the public interest. Welcome back. Sally in St. Louisville, Ohio. Hey, Sally, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, I tried to get a hold of the program when Bernie Sanders was on. I know you are in support of an amendment that moved to amend, the 28th that moved to amend, would have us have, and we're trying to get. I'm an affiliate, or my group is an affiliate of Move to Amend. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to find out is if you know if Bernie supports that amendment as it stands, or is he saying that some organizations should be exempt? And my feeling, and I'm pretty sure it's Move to Amend's feeling, is that we should make it clear that we're only talking about natural human beings having constitutional rights and being considered legal persons, individual human beings, that whether you like, a particular organization or not. I mean, I like NAACP. I like unions. I obviously like Move to Amend, but organizations, anything that is not a natural human being does not deserve legal personhood and constitutional rights. They would be governed by statutorial rights, in other words, by laws.
Right.
So do you, and I think you feel that way too, if I'm not mistaken.
I do. I can't speak for Bernie. What I can tell you is that the constitutional amendment, which failed in the Senate, actually passed the Senate last week, but failed to overcome a Republican filibuster. That constitutional amendment exclusively dealt with money being considered speech by the Supreme Court. Spending money being considered free speech, and it did not deal with the issue of corporate personhood. The issue, and you know, Bernie supported that. Whether he supports the Move to Amend amendment, I believe that people have called, and he's said that he does. But I can't speak on behalf of the senator. I can tell you that I do know something about the internal politics of this, and I've had this essentially debate on the air on a couple of occasions over the last 2 or 3 years with both union representatives and representatives of national public interest groups. Public Citizen is probably the most visible, where they're saying that they think personhood should be stripped from for-profit corporations, but not not-for-profit corporations, because they, of course, are not-for-profit corporations. And they have a lot of influence with the Democratic Party. And I'm saying that if unions and if you know, Public Citizen, and if all of these groups, if they all lost their rights under the Constitution, along with Koch Industries and you know, fill in the blank, all the other big corporations, if they all lost their rights under the Constitution, that would work to the advantage, actually, of these nonprofits that are membership-based organizations and that are democratically run, which is unions. Unions are democracies in the workplace. If a corporation loses its right to lobby as a person, the most they can do is have their CEO send a letter out to their 10,000 employees. Well, the 10,000 employees are going to say, well, the CEO's interests are not the same as mine. On the other hand, if there's a union in that organization and 51% of the members say, yes, we want to take this political position, and they send that out to their members, you're going to get some action with or without corporate personhood. So I think it's a mistake that the Democrats are making. But, you know, this is the battle that's going on. Sally, thank you for the call. Helping you in the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is George Schrauer. Am I saying that right, George? Schrauer?
Yeah, you got it.
Great.
Schrauer, yep.
Okay, the founder of Building Tomorrow. You're building schools in East Africa, 18 schools and counting so far. The website is buildingtomorrow.org. You're in New York City right now for the 10th Annual Clinton Global Initiative. Okay. And tell us about Building Tomorrow, George.
Well, we're an organization that's been around for 8 years doing a lot of work to help provide access to quality education in Uganda and hopefully East Africa as well. We currently have, as you mentioned, 18 schools that we're working on. We have another 5 that are actually under construction, and we're in the middle of launching a fellowship program, which is taking collegiate graduates from Uganda and putting them in very rural based classrooms to help improve the quality of leadership amongst head teachers and teachers in the school.
That is absolutely great. Are you? I'm assuming you're building schools for girls as well as boys.
Yes, we actually have about an even split in terms of enrollment, and we do a lot of work to ensure that we have women represented on a lot of the management and construction committees that we employ to get our schools built.
Have you encountered any blowback from this? I know in Nigeria, for example, Boko Haram is going out to schools that educate girls and burning them down and kidnapping girls and things. Has that migrated to Uganda?
No, luckily that kind of sentiment towards girls' education does not exist in Uganda, but it's one that one that obviously we share a lot of concern over, just because there's so much work that needs to be done in sub-Saharan Africa to ensure universal access for boys and for girls.
Yeah, how did you start Building Tomorrow?
We started actually. I served as an intern with the United Nations World Food Program for a summer, and studied a school feeding program, which was an interesting way to gain access to schools, because a lot of kids were coming to school just because their parents were being promised that they would be fed in exchange for coming to class. And so we began 8 years ago and have been growing pretty steadily since.
Wow, that's great. George, any last things that you think that our audience needs to know about the work that you're doing or what's going on with the Clinton Global Initiative this week in New York City?
Well, you know, it's obviously an awesome collection of companies, of foundations, organizations that are doing great work all throughout the world, and we're very proud to be one of the many organizations that are represented here, and looking forward to making our impact in the world as we can.
Great, George Schrauer. The website is buildingtomorrow.org. George, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Great talking with you. It's great. I've spent a fair amount of time in Uganda. It's a country very close to my heart. Massive climate change protests on Wall Street right now. This is it's very interesting. What's going on there? We'll see how that develops and how that plays out. So far, it seems that everything is peaceful. Judy in Healdsburg, California. Judy. Judy is not listening to her telephone. Ron, in Samanok, Illinois. Am I saying that right, Ron?
You got it.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the media and faction?
Yes. There are many other subjects, which even our own liberal media, which is corporate-owned, has not mentioned. Like one that comes to mind is net neutrality.
Yeah, you will hear no discussion of net neutrality of any consequence on MSNBC, if that's what you're talking about.
Yes, I didn't want to mention the network, but yeah. And the pro-choice marches have been growing, and we have not heard any of, you know, any press on that. There's been many issues which we're not hearing, even the Citizens United, we're not hearing any press on that. It's been squelched very, very thoroughly.
Well, these right-wing groups have, there are PR shops here in Washington, D.C., and they're not cheap. And they, you know, when the Tea Party has a meeting and they get these $350,000 buses and paint them all up nice and fancy and bus in a bunch of people, and then they call the media. I mean, they spend millions on PR and advertising, and people on the left just show up. They don't spend the millions on PR and advertising. And because, frankly, they don't have it, because they're not a faction. They're not interested in private, you know, interests. They're interested in the public good, and the public good does not pay. So, Ron, excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up? You have an alternative to sidewalk chalk?
Well, in a supplement to it, I love the idea of different colored chalks because it's inexpensive, it's flexible, it's less criminal in the eyes of repos. And it's a good supplement to the electronic, you know, the lighted up signs that you see on the side of buildings in the evening that they do with
right.
music.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, so here's some other things you can do. What I like to do is I like to write messages to do with current events and critiques of different politicians on the back and front of my currency before I spend them. I first demagnetize the money in the microwave and the magnet, and then I put messages on the money. I like to do that. I like to pass out anonymously DVDs to different neighbors' kids, drop them off at the local library or the school. You do that every once in a while. I like an answer to True the Vote, which the repos like to do. They like to watch black people vote. Well, then we need to start watching the rednecks vote. I mean, stuff to irritate them, we just do a mirror of what they do.
Yeah. Well, just because somebody is doing something that's awful and reprehensible doesn't mean that we should. But your message on money thing, I mean, you know, Ben Cohen has, you know, he's all about that. He's got these, you know, stamp machines that you can buy over at his website. And if you stick into a search engine, Ben Cohen and stamp machine, it'll pop right up. They're rubber stamps that are self-inking. And you stamp a dollar bill, and it has a, you know, money is not speech slogan on it, and, you know, tells you where you can go on the internet to get more information. So that's a, you know, it's a great suggestion. Johnny, thank you for your activism, and keep it up. We'll be back. We've got an interesting day today. Steve Cohen is going to be with us in our next hour. In our third hour, Phil Donahue is going to drop by, and Norman Solomon. And not to mention your calls and the news of the day, and there's a whole lot of it. So we will get back to all of that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And is Professor Cohen available? We're getting... Oh, he's online. Oh, there he is. Professor Stephen Cohen is back with us. He's contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is just now out in paperback. His most recent piece for The Nation, The Chance Putin Has Given Obama for Diplomacy, thenation.com, of course, the website for that. Dr. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thanks, but let me correct something you said.
Please.
The Nation does all sorts of fiddling with things. I don't know exactly what that is that you mentioned at thenation.com.
Uh-huh.
And it might be an updated piece, but I still, for the moment, feel strongly that the article in the magazine by me maybe a week or so ago on the web called Patriotic Heresy Versus the New Cold War is the most relevant piece. But thanks for having me on again.
I'm pleased to have you. Patriotic Heresy
Against the New Cold War.
Okay. So I saw a piece on Democratic Underground this morning about how here's a grave of a Russian soldier in Ukraine proving that the Russians have invaded Ukraine. This kind of rhetoric. What are your thoughts on that? What's the situation in Ukraine right now? What's the situation in between the United States and Russia?
I don't remember the last time you and I spoke, but it's been, I think, at least perhaps 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So maybe it would be helpful if I did a brief overview of what's happened and where we are now.
Sure.
Would that be okay?
That would be perfect.
At the end of August, almost a month ago, there was a dramatic change in the military struggle in eastern Ukraine. It appeared to Western politicians and the Western media that Kiev, the regime we support in Ukraine, was going to crush eastern Ukraine, particularly the two large cities, the pro-Russian cities, Donetsk and Lugansk. They were bombarding the cities. You know, there are 3,000, the UN says, are dead, about 1 million displaced. The economic infrastructure of that industrial heartland of Ukraine has been badly damaged. And it appeared, that Kiev, and therefore indirectly the United States and NATO, would take the whole of Ukraine and dictate whatever negotiations ensued to Putin and Russia. And then there was a dramatic reversal of fortune, and the self-defenders of the rebel army crushed in about 10 days the Ukrainian army, which fled, leaving its heavy artillery behind. The president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, said yesterday that Kiev lost 65% of its heavy equipment during those 6, 8, 9, 10 days.
Oh.
That transformed the political situation. And Poroshenko, in effect, sued for peace. Putin agreed to a set of negotiations. The rebels agreed to a set of negotiations. There was a ceasefire declared and various conditions, including exchange of prisoners. And that's what's going on now. Now, equally importantly, however, the war parties, that is, the groups that do not want the ceasefire and the negotiations, those war parties in Kiev, Washington, and in Brussels, the headquarters of NATO, have launched a major, so to speak, offensive against peace here.
Why would they not want peace?
Well, but let's remember what they're doing, because your listeners will remember what's happened in the last few days. Poroshenko came to Washington and addressed Congress. Rather unusual for a president who is president of half a country and hasn't achieved anything, but they did it. That was the doing of the war party. And the demand arose that we give Kiev heavier equipment so it could fight on. The American commander of NATO made the same statement yesterday. And in Kiev, Poroshenko himself is under attack by radical forces on the right, ultra-nationalists, on the grounds that he's sold out. Even Putin is under some pressure in Moscow that the ceasefire is not in Russia's interest. But that's a separate story. Why would they do that? Why would anyone want the civilians of eastern Ukraine to suffer more than they have for literally nothing? And if you're interested in why I say nothing, I will tell you in a minute. The only reason that I can think of in the minds of these people in Washington, Brussels, and Kiev is twofold. Either they think it's time for an ultimate showdown with Putin's Russia, They literally want war with Russia. They want Russia in full scale, NATO in full scale, and to end this specter of Putin. They've imagined him to be some kind of monster. It's nonsense. The other possibility, and more rational perhaps, is that these people think that if they can regain military victory in eastern Ukraine, they, the West, can dictate the terms of peace. That is, they will dictate what the whole of Ukraine will be when war ends. It's an impossible goal, but we pursue impossible goals around the world all the time, and we have in Iraq, Afghanistan, probably now in Syria. So just because it's not achievable, just because it's irrational, doesn't mean that our policymakers are not pursuing it. But that's where things stand now.
So does any of this have anything to do with this $10 billion deal that Chevron cut with the original Ukrainian government to frack for gas and oil? Apparently there's an awful lot of gas and oil under the ground in Ukraine that has been recently discovered.
Well, that's true. Not as much of oil and gas that is under the ground in Russia, where ExxonMobil now, because of the sanctions, has to withdraw its equipment and stop, or even in Crimea offshore, which Russia annexed, where there's said to be possibly an enormous amount of oil and gas. So the answer is yes. But, you know, Tom, as a historian and when I taught my graduate and undergraduate students, I always made the argument that for any momentous event, war, revolution, there was never one factor that caused it. There were several factors. And then I asked the students to list those that are more important. Did economic motives influence our exceedingly unwise policies in Ukraine? I'm sure they did. But I don't think they were factor number one. I think the larger factor was this thinking that all the former Soviet republics, all the countries around Russia, should be in NATO, and Russia should forever be deprived of the status of a great power. I think that's been the secret dream, aspiration, of a small but exceedingly influential faction in Washington and in Europe since the end of the Soviet Union, because the expansion of NATO began in the 1990s under Clinton.
Yeah, would these be the people that we refer to as neoconservatives?
Yeah, they come or go, but let's not be kind to people you and I used to look to for wisdom. The liberal wing of the American political spectrum, including progressives, has a group called liberal interventionists. And I see no difference between their ideology of American foreign policy and that of the neoconservatives. In fact, many people have observed that they've formed a kind of axis or alliance in American politics, making them the majority, at least in the foreign policy elite, that influences what a president and what Congress does. So I think this is a bipartisan folly. I don't know if you saw the front page of the New York Times today, but
not.
In effect, it reports that the nuclear arms race with Russia is on again.
Oh, I read that article, yeah.
I mean, it's on again. I've been speaking about this, about the closer we get to Russia with NATO, the more Russia's going to fall back on its nuclear weapons,
right,
because it doesn't have our conventional weapons. And now you see the American response. It's called a nuclear arms race.
Yeah, not a good thing, history tells us. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us. His newest piece, do I have this right? Patriotic Heresy Against a New Cold War?
Yes.
Okay, great. For The Nation, thenation.com. And we will be right back with more of Professor Cohen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Professor Cohen's book, which is out newly in paperback, is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which talks about the New Cold War as well. Welcome back. Professor Cohen, some months ago when you and I were talking about this situation with Ukraine and Russia and NATO and the United States, we talked about, in fact, I think it was the week that was the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, or, you know, some consequential event that triggered World War One, and, you know, the possibility that this conflict in Ukraine, could be an Archduke Ferdinand moment. And can we revisit that conversation?
Well, if I had educated myself more about the origins of World War One, we could. I understand the analogy, and people are commenting on it a lot. But I think there's something different now. You could argue that back in November 2013, when this crisis in Ukraine began, remember what happened. What began as a political crisis provoked by the European Union in November 13, then became a Ukrainian civil war, then became a proxy war between the West and Russia, and now risk becoming, it already is, a new Cold War, but the possibility of hot war with Russia remains. So I would say that since now we know so much more about what's going on in Ukraine and about the policies being made in the West, that accident is no longer the driving force. There is intent here. Some powerful factions in the Western capitals want something out of this crisis, and they're not satisfied with a negotiated outcome that leaves Russia in a strong negotiating position. They need to be stopped. To stop them, there's only one way: Western leadership. The Western leader who's done the most to stop them is Chancellor Merkel of Germany. The Western leader who could do the most to stop them is President Obama of the United States. But his role at best has been ambiguous, and at worst, he's put himself at the head of the war party. So I think at this point, people know. Let me tell you what the tragedy is, because I feel very agitated about this because my own country is implicated. All this began in November 2013, when the European Union unwisely offered the then-elected president of Ukraine a so-called partnership agreement with the European Union based on trade. And they excluded Russia. They said Russia could not be a part of it. Putin said, let's discuss this in a tripart way. You remember, Ukraine was in financial crisis. Now it's in complete crisis. Everything is collapsing in Ukraine. But remember what happened a couple of weeks ago in Minsk, the capital of Belarus. The European Union asked the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, and begged Putin to come to discuss a tripart economic relationship, even though Poroshenko had signed now the agreement with the European Union.
Bilateral.
That is to say, to put it crudely, a minimum of 3,000 civilians have died, mostly older people, women, children. 1 million or more Ukrainians are refugees, displaced, mainly in Russia, but also in Ukraine. The infrastructure, industrial infrastructure of Ukraine, including the coal industry, and winter is coming, have been shattered. And what has resulted is exactly what could have been had economically and politically in November. And all these people have died for nothing, suffered for nothing.
I want to recap that very quickly. We'll be right back with Professor Stephen Cohen, writing for TheNation.com. Welcome back. Stephen Cohen is with us, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, is out now in paperback. It examines the new Cold War. His most recent piece for TheNation.com, Patriotic Heresy Against a New Cold War. Professor Cohen, you were just mentioning that in November of last year, this situation in Ukraine sort of came to a head, or there was a pivot point, and now we're approaching a very similar pivot point, and in the middle of this, a bunch of people have died and been displaced unnecessarily. Do I have that right? Can you recap that very quickly?
The Ukrainian crisis was created by history, a divided Ukraine, but the political crisis was created by Western policy, which in November 2013 told the elected president of Ukraine he had to choose economically between Russia and the West. When he chose Russia, he was overthrown by a street mob. The current government came to power, essentially through a coup. The United States and Europe backed this coup government. That led to the Civil War and brought us to where we are. And yet, a month or so ago, the European Union changed its mind because of Ukraine was losing the war and said to Putin, oh, we've had a second thought. Never mind. Please come and let us discuss how we can work out this economic trade arrangement so that Russia, the European Union, and Ukraine participate. Still more, Tom, still more, fantastically. They delayed the implementation of the trade agreement with the European Union that the president of Ukraine had signed until 2016.
So is this not a good sign? Doesn't this mean that
it's a good sign unless you take a human point of view?
Right.
3,000 people, Tom, and that's a low figure, have died. A million have been displaced, their lives wrecked forever. Ukraine is sinking economically. It needs billions, tens and tens of billions of dollars to survive. Right. And for what? The ambitions of a faction that wants Ukraine in NATO, but formally for a trade agreement that could have been negotiated very easily in November 2013, was rejected by the West, and the West is now suing for economic peace with Putin. Right. So one day, those of us who say this today are called Putin apologists. We're not. We're American patriots. We know the damage this has done to American national security. But one day, historians will look back, as they do on the beginning of the beginning of World War I, and ask who was responsible. Which leaders made these decisions that resulted in all this tragedy and brought about nothing good? And I think, unfortunately, our government is going to find itself on the wrong side of the scales of historical justice.
Unless they get with the program that Angela Merkel is promoting.
Well, now that brings us to the day. I mean, let me fiddle with the front page of the New York Times. They've bumped the Ukrainian program, though they continue to cover it, and the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, and the networks, to the back pages.
Sure, because of ISIS.
Yeah. But I submit to you that the fate of international relations and of history is being waged not in the Middle East, which is very much a regional issue, except for Obama's unwise policies, which are internationalizing it. But the real fate of world politics is being decided in Ukraine today, even though it's off the front pages. And so the next maybe week or two, when we see how these struggles in Washington, Brussels, Kiev, and even in Moscow, because Putin's now under a new kind of pressure, we see how these struggles go, whether negotiations among Ukrainians get traction and begin to produce a political equilibrium that can last, we will see, or whether, in effect, the Ukrainian war, civil war, proxy war, resumes.
Did Russia invade Ukraine, and if so, is that a war crime or something to which we should respond?
Well, at the moment, three human rights organizations, Helsinki Watch, Amnesty International, and one other, have charged Kiev, our regime, with war crimes for having bombed and shelled large residential cities. The Russians have not been accused of any war crimes, except to the extent that you believe that they were involved in the shootdown of that Malaysian airliner, for which there is at the moment no evidence. War crimes were committed, but by the side we backed. Did Russia invade Ukraine? To a certain extent, it's a matter of language. Did Russia send military help and advisors and possibly fighters in August to help the rebels turn around the war in eastern Ukraine? Yes. Was that an invasion? Tom, you and I are old enough to know what a Russian invasion looks like.
Yeah.
Paratroopers are dropped, hundreds of them behind the lines. Long columns of armored personnel carrier, tanks, pour across the border. The communication system of the enemy country is shut down by Russian technology.
Yeah.
None of that happened. Russia sent men to help the rebels. What I think happened is they didn't so much send fighters, but the rebel army was a guerrilla army, and Russia understood it had to be turned into a regular army with sergeants and lieutenants and platoons and battalions. That was Russia's contribution, plus some heavier weapons. It turned it around. But essentially, the defenders in eastern Ukraine, about 9,000 to 12,000 of them, defeated the 50,000 to 70,000 man Ukrainian army.
Remarkable. Professor Cohen, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Professor Stephen Cohen, TheNation.com, Patriotic Heresy Against the New Cold War, in his book, Soviet Fates. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
My thanks to you.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot in the news, a lot going on. And, you know, we'll see how this situation in Ukraine plays out. We'll see how the situation in the Middle East plays out, in Syria, in, well, all across the region. I mean, it's Libya's falling apart as we speak. Iraq is functionally in the middle of another civil war. Afghanistan has been melting down continuously ever since we took down the Taliban. And it's just, you know, step by step by step, American foreign policy over the last, well, since George Bush became president, basically, has just been an ongoing disaster. And, you know, hopefully cooler heads will prevail, as they say. John in El Monte, California. Hey, John, you want to talk about the Middle East? John? John's not listening to his phone. Robin in Kingston, Washington. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to focus on the marching in New York City on Sunday and other activities. Today in Truth Dig, Juan Cole has posted an article that I think is very prescient and important, and that is that sometimes big marches don't have the outcome that people think or the people they want. Now, this is a positive, challenging phone call for the left and for you personally, because I listen to you a lot, and I know that you are very well impressed by your youth engagement on the streets up in Madison or wherever. I forget where you were, but anyway, it's Detroit somewhere in Michigan, I think. And the concept that is presented, and just I represented it on my blog in your website. It's the only place it's presented. It's called civil informationing. And the idea is for that to stand alongside civil disobedience and civil resistance, and it includes more people because you are legal, friendly, and it's all based on civil discussion and just basically information. And I would encourage you to read that, really think about this, maybe have Juan Cole on the show to expand this concept. And basically, it is, in fact, Kashama Swant, I gave her a copy of civil information, and she used it. And she spread her people out, and she got elected successfully the second time that she tried, which is the time I gave her the civil information document on her second election. I said, spread your people out. You'll get this win. So the whole concept is simply as follows. 4,000 people going to go to a march. Instead of doing it as traditional in the 60s, break that 4,000 people into 1,000 groups of four. Find 1,000 corners in your region, okay, like Seattle. I'm trying so hard to get the Seattle region to pull this off because it'd be so successful. Anyways, 1,000 corners, four people, use the pedestrian lights to keep on walking across the streets, have some signs, have some handouts, have nice discussions with people. And then after you've done that for 2 or 3 hours in the morning, go to a local park, like in Seattle, Gasworks Park, and then have your rally and fun and everything like that. The reason this came about is because in the early 2000s, I was standing against the war when I was living in Reno, Nevada, and I just saw that we hadn't moved our tactics, okay, of public engagement moved ahead. So I came up with the concept of civil informationing.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea, Robin. And, you know, if the Moonies and the Hare Krishnas can do it, so can we. Excellent point. Thank you very much for the call. Gary in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Yes, hello, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering why there's nobody that will ask the Republicans what plans do they have for the middle class and the poor. I think it'll give them a 15-20% boost in the polls, because the people have a right to know. The only thing they can say is either duh or cheap labor.
Well, actually, the Republicans have been very consistent about this since 1981. And their message is, if we give more tax breaks to big corporations, lower the corporate tax rate, and to billionaires, if we give more tax breaks to very, very wealthy, that money will trickle down, the job creators will be happy, and they will therefore build factories, and everything will be wonderful in America. And for 34 years, we've given massive cuts. I mean, you know, trillions of dollars, tens of trillions of dollars in tax breaks and tax cuts to corporations and rich people. And it hasn't trickled down yet. And what's happening, I think, is that the Republicans, every time they say this, well, just give it another Friedman unit, you know, just give it another 6 months. Just people aren't buying it anymore. But I think your point is really well taken, Gary. We need to call them out on this insanity. Morris in Long Beach, listening to KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
I want to give a shout out to Chelsea Manning and Chuck Hagel. Look out, somebody vying for your job. She's right. All we have to do is just kick back, let that thing play out. And they might want to follow Mr. Abraham Lincoln's advice.
You're talking about the Middle East.
The Middle East. I'm sorry, Professor. I assume everybody understands what you and I are. Yes, I'm talking about the Middle East and what's going on over there with ISIS. And we need to bomb these people in ISIS, that what they call moderate murderers. But anyway, what they might want to do is follow Abraham Lincoln's advice and give a couple of those guys, that those two jobs that are remaining there in the Iraqi government. All right? Share power. It would minimize a whole lot of violence, and I guarantee the people that are being displaced would appreciate something like that if these guys would swallow their pride a little bit. Give those guys those two jobs. Now, you're going to have problems, obviously, but everything would be worked out through the governmental system.
Yeah.
Probably going to hire their friends or whatnot, but it's all worked out through that system there, because now they're part of it. You have to include them. Mm. The way the thing is set up right now, we're excluding them. We want to call them derogatory names as if we're better people, and that's just not going to get it done. So, again, Chelsea, as far as I'm concerned, I know your address has changed, and I know your attire has changed, but you ought to be running the military defense for this country in the Middle East. That's just my own opinion.
Yeah. Well said, Morris. Thank you very much for the call. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, you wanted to talk about Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, bear with me. I got a few dots I want to tie here. Hey, a shout-out to your excellent crew. I'm going to continue with one dot. They asked the question, why would I vote for Bernie?
Mm-hmm.
I answered with the excellent, you and your co-author, Sustin, your guys.
Yeah, Dan Sustin.
Of Howard Zinn. God bless you all. Connect the dot where he said, we done got away from the fundamentals, and you continue it with fractions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's bring it up to date. Well, bring it from the past. Whoever said no taxation without representation, let's bring it up to date. No work without representation. That's the rallying cry Bernie needs, Elizabeth Warren needs, and this is why I would vote for them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, no work without representation. All these people flooding Wall Street now. They talking about they want equal economic justice. The people there say, well, how do we get it? Trickle down. You just talk about trickle down. We know that don't work. Communist socialism, the Islamics, that don't work. So the natural thing is cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
And to get there is democracy. So.
Yeah, democracy in the workplace.
I would say, what would get me to vote for Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, that wonderful socialist lady in Seattle? What would get me to vote for them? If they had a rallying cry of no work without representation.
Okay, Jesse, you've laid out a great slogan, a great bumper sticker. And I think, you know, one that probably has, if not directly, indirectly, animated the labor movement for 100 years. Judy in Hellsburg, California. Hey, Judy, you wanted to talk about the climate march?
Hello, Tom, and I want to thank you for the incredible work you do on in every way. I wanted to share a perspective. You spoke about the corporate media's handling of the march. I witnessed something like this in 1990. I'm sure the rest of America didn't know about the first and only animal rights march on Washington, which was a total, total success, probably close to, I don't know, 80,000, close to 100,000 people. And I really paid attention to it. Christopher Reeves was still alive. He gave a speech to everybody. I hate to say that he was booed off the stage. He talked about vivisection, how a little bit is necessary. They booed him right off the stage. But the next day, I wanted to see what the Washington Post did with it. They reported 25,000 people, and it was close to 100,000 people, and all they did was zero in on negatives, And I just, you know, I'm just appalled that there's no truth. I mean, it's you, it's Democracy Now, and that I really worry about the future, that all the important news is blanked out. And and I just wanted to add something, too, that you spoke about. I'm trying to get everything in. Is that a few weeks ago you were talking about how the local police departments are purchasing military weapons and the whole thing that's happening. I kind of call myself a psychic historian. This is something that really we have to pay attention to. It's no accident that it's happening. The more repression that happens, the mainstream understands and they're preparing. They're simply preparing, and that's a great concern to me, too. And one more point, I wish the environmentalists could include animal rights in their agenda. This has always been hard for me since 1989.
Yeah, a great place to start with that, Judy, is factory farms. You know, factory farms are not only a moral a holocaust, I mean, not only a moral affront, but they're also incredibly bad for our environment. But, yeah, right across. I see it all as one thing. Obviously, you do, too. Judy, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching this week. We will be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And about 5 minutes from now, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service will be dropping by. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ian, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in West Palm Beach, Florida. Ian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to call and bring up an issue that I feel with the ISIL situation in the Middle East. ISIL is in control of oil production facilities in both Syria and Iraq.
Right.
And they are pumping tens of thousands of gallons a day and selling it on the black market. This is an example of faction leading our foreign policy, because that's what's really pumping behind us. It isn't anything else that's going on. And the petro lobby and the financial system lobby are both of the people that are pushing our government to take these actions over there. Again, in my opinion.
You think to recover the oil fields?
Absolutely. To stop the black market sale of the oil. The speculation on Wall Street that's going on right now with this black market oil, it's messing up everything they're
doing.
Right.
The price of oil has been dropping.
Absolutely. And think about it. With the speculators, if they're hedging with these credit default swaps, it won't take too many of those being forced into paying off that could start the whole house of cards just like back in 2008 again.
So ISIS selling oil on the black market could collapse the price of oil to the point where the credit default swaps on oil, the insurance policies basically that the gamblers on Wall Street are buying against a collapse in the price of oil, start getting called in. And when enough of those insurance policies get called in, the whole system collapses just like it did in 2008.
Bingo.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
I think there's a lot to what you have to say. Ian, thank you for calling and sharing it. Michael in Denver. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, thank you. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to call briefly here. You were talking about, number one, about us not teaching civics.
Right.
I just want to bring it back to memory here. When I was in public school back in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a handbook of American government, and I can picture it in my mind. I've never been able to find it, though. It's kind of like disappeared off the face of the earth. But it was a great primer for kids in elementary and middle school or junior high school, is from where I'm from back east, to learn about the process of government. And it was actually a very, very interesting book because we really got into that. From what I remember back then talking, and we had people, of course, assemblymen and people. Actually, the mayor of New York even once came to our school and talked to the whole assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bob Wagner.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to mention is that I hear local news in our little hamlet out here in Colorado, the Jefferson County Schools is really going to war with its teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to revamp the pay system here, and it's part of a ploy of basically getting rid of the older teachers. and also getting rid of the union. But one of the sidebars is that the teachers are also being vocal about changes in teaching advanced placement history. Evidently, some of this is kind of a precursor to what the people in Texas are doing, changing the books around.
Yeah.
And what I've told parents and all is, if those books hit your school, you hit the school. You get out there on the sidewalk and say, we do not want these books in our schools. It doesn't matter. Take it all the way to the Supreme Court if you have to.
Yeah, I'm with you, Michael. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Denver on Free Speech TV. We'll be back with Ellen Ratner in just a moment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. In the studio
with us. By
the way,
speaking of free-don.org, did you understand that it was the judge that sentenced him that got into all that big trouble?
Mark Fuller. And I thought it was in this pile of stuff that I had right here in my hand, but apparently it's not. Anyhow, yes, we did a riff on it last week.
Great. That's
this,
great.
This judge who was beating his wife, apparently. Or
right.
His, you know, he's the guy who also beat up Don Siegelman, arguably.
Exactly.
And had run against him politically.
And Governor Siegelman had always told me this guy was not on the up and up, so
yeah,
to speak.
Apparently.
Okay, so, you know, Tom, I have been covering the White House a very long period of time, and sometimes I get very annoyed with my colleagues, and today was one of them. So I left the briefing. I didn't stay at the whole thing because I had to get over here. But I left the briefing about 47 minutes into the briefing today. And in that first 47 minutes, not one thing was brought up about climate change. They spent the entire time on the Secret Service guy that had, you know, run across the lawn.
Which
and what
is
was
kind of non-news.
It's totally non-news. And everybody knows there's going to be a intense looking at what happened and there may be new rules. Do we really need to take up our time with that? And the second thing was ISIS-ISIL, which I'll talk about. But not one thing about climate change, despite the fact that, as you know, that's starting at the United Nations tomorrow.
Well, this is just like the Sunday shows. All three of the networks completely ignored it. The cable news networks did not play it live over the weekend. On the other hand, they're taking millions from the fossil fuel industry to run ads on clean coal and natural gas and fracking and how BP is wonderful. And, you know, so
And also, I have to go after, and I'm a Harvard alum, not undergraduate, but graduate, President Drew Faust, who's saying that they're not going to get rid of any of their holdings in any of this. Well,
they're not going to divest.
I got news for her. This is like the Vietnam era. That's what they said in the beginning, too.
Yeah, or apartheid.
But I do want to say that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations today actually gave a very good speech about the climate conference tomorrow. He mentioned the march twice in New York. And so I thought that was really good. I mean, He is clearly responding to that.
Great.
Okay. So there was all this stuff about the Secret Service. The only thing I'm going to say is that there were changes that were implemented right away, and there's going to be this big hearing. And, of course, now, because there's all different kinds of groups, including the Park Police and the D.C. Police that are involved, it does get complicated. Now, more on to ISIS-ISIL. And what is going on with that? The president is, we know that President Putin is very involved in this. And as the White House said, there are areas that we can negotiate with President Putin on, and ISIS-ISIL is one of them.
Yeah.
So that is obviously very good news. The White House is saying that they are going to step up airstrikes, and that had they were questioned by some of the press, well, what happens? How come you haven't, how come you didn't arm some of these Syrian rebel groups that were in favor of before? They said, well, they were afraid of this getting into the wrong hands. Well, why now? They didn't really have an answer for that. But they did say that they are going to step up airstrikes. Now, the other question is, what part is the United States going to have with Iran. There is that P5 plus one group that is meeting about Iran's nuclear capacity. They say that is still going to go on. There are going to be side conversations on this, but that the United States is not going to share intelligence with them and is not going to engage with them in the ISIS-ISIL issue, that is going to be separate.
That's interesting. It was one of the talkers' conventions, and I think it was in the last year or two of the Bush administration. I was there. You were there. My recollection is that you were standing with me when I had this conversation. Maybe not. Stanley McChrystal was there, the
right.
general. And I said, you know, what's your opinion of this war? And he said, we can't kill our way to victory on this. And even if we were to try to kill our way to victory, we have no metric for who we have to kill and how many we have to kill before we can claim victory. And I'm wondering, now that we're amping up the killing in Syria and Iraq,
we certainly are amping up that killing.
How and when do we know that we've killed enough to have killed our way to victory?
Well, that is a very good question, and you need to be part of the White House press corps because nobody asked that.
Wow.
Then there are some other issues that are going on, and one is that apparently there are some separate non-government organizations now that are really trying to figure out who is funding ISIL-ISIS. And the question was, is the United States in support of these organizations, these non-government organizations, or are they not? The White House actually answered that they are in support of these organizations.
So wait a minute. We support the organizations that are outing who's funding ISIS.
Exactly.
You know, at the end of the day, it's going to come back to Saudi Arabia.
Well,
I
know from our experience in the UAE that they often talk with forked tongue.
Yeah.
And on one hand, they do one thing, and the other hand, you know, some of these airlines are putting on all kinds of weapons and things like that that we supposedly don't know about.
Yeah. Pardon my.
Now, that's okay. All right. Some other things is, of course, the humanitarian situation. The president is expected to take this up. Now, by the way, the president is going to be running a session of the Security Council that he is running. It's only the second time that a U.S. president has actually run a session of the Security Council.
When was the first time?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I have a feeling it was Clinton, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
So this is going to be, and they're going to focus on ISIS-ISIL, and that is what the president is going to be doing. Then they were asked today about this coalition. Well, is it together yet? And the White House would only say it's going to be continuing, and we expect it to change many times.
I saw Tony Blair being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer, and I'm like, oh, no. You know, deja vu all over again.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I remember when we first went into Iraq the first time, and Tony Blair came to the White House. This ages me because it was a long time ago, right after 9/11. And I asked a British guy, well, do you think Britain is going to be involved in this in Iraq? And he said, well, Tony Blair just loves this kind of stuff, of course.
Oh, jeez. So, in other words, he's a neocon war hawk.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And I heard that from the BBC guy.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
It's always nice to have you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Wow. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I'm really, really honored to have in the studio with me both Norman Solomon and Phil Donahue, the great Phil Donahue. And, gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. Body of War, this new movie did you help write this, Phil Donahue?
Well, it was my idea, and I am EP. I paid for the film.
Right.
And so I was sort of the, I was the gorilla in the room. But I had, obviously, a lot of help. And it was as much TV and, documentary things that I've hosted. It's the first time I've ever made a film, and it was quite an adventure. I called cold a woman in Texas who, thank God, recognized me. I said, I met this kid at Walter Reed, and I want to do a documentary, and would you meet me at the Kansas City airport? She did. We went to meet this young man, and she grabbed the idea with both hands and turned out to be a wonderful filmmaker. I was just very lucky in so many ways.
That is great. We're talking about the film Body of War, which is screening tonight here in Washington, D.C. at American University. And Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon, you guys are going to be there for this gig, right? So those of you who are listening in the D.C. area, if you want to show up there, the Roots Action, it's co-sponsored by Roots Action, rootsaction.org. The website for the movie itself is bodyofwar.com. And tell us about the documentary. What is it? What is it?
It's the story of a 24-year-old Kansas City kid who saw the president on the pile with the megaphone.
Bush.
Mm-hmm. And, he wanted to get the evildoers, too. Mm-hmm. So he goes directly to Fort Hood, signs up. He thought he was going to Afghanistan. He's in Iraq 5 days and an open truck. I think there were several soldiers in the back with him. The bullet came down and entered his collarbone here, exits T4 on the spine, which is between shoulder blades. So Thomas Young is paralyzed from the nipples down.
Wow.
Thomas can't cough. A 24-year-old prime-of-life male, impotent. And when I met him at Walter Reed, his mother explained his injury to me. And you look at this and think, people should see this. This is the most sanitized war of my lifetime.
Mm. Oh, Bush wouldn't even let us see coffins coming out.
And the whole press corps said, okay. Yeah. And I'm thinking, if you're going to send the young men and women, this is hardly original thought, show the pain. We still haven't really seen the sacrifice. And what you see in our film is a drama that's playing itself out in thousands of homes in this country. Truly catastrophic injuries. Thomas will never walk, ever.
Yeah.
Since June of 04 or April of 04, he's been in bed.
Right.
He has since had a pulmonary embolism. He can't. He's fed through a tube. He's had a colostomy. So, and he's married to a fabulous woman who feeds him abdominally. And all the commercials on television are about food.
Right.
He cannot consume food orally.
Wow.
We've never been this close to a catastrophic injury in our lives, any of us. And it was a spiritual experience. And if I could just take one second, I wanted this to be a political film. I didn't want this to be, and he didn't either, oh, lad, poor lad, how sad.
Right.
So what you see in this program as you watch him deal with his new body, you see the Iraq highlights of the Iraq War resolution debate in both houses of Congress. And what you see are members of the Senate and the House, like obedient third graders who were called to the White House by Karl Rove and the White House Iraq Group.
Right.
These are the advertising agency,
right, the
warriors.
Right.
They name our invasions, shock.
Yeah.
And they wrote, a smoking gun will become a mushroom cloud. The longer we wait, the more dangerous he becomes. Saddam had more weapons of mass destruction than Hitler ever had. And they immediately go to the floor and read. It's unbelievable. This is the most shallow congressional debate that led to a massive blunder that we will deal with now for the rest of this century and beyond. It is unbelievable to see how nobody was thinking for themselves. And it was
other than Barbara Lee.
And Barbara Lee and 23 senators, by the way, voted no. Yeah. 23. 77 senators. Hillary, John Kerry, our Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel.
Voted yes. Voted he was a aye. Republican then.
The only Republican to vote no was Lincoln Chafee of Vermont. And he was to lose his reelection bid. I'm pleased to know that he was elected as governor of Rhode Island. But I couldn't believe what I was watching, and I thought people should see this too. Yeah. So it's woven throughout. This is a very painful close-up look at what we mean when we say harm in harm's way. Right. And I said, Thomas, I can't do this without your permission. I want to see this. And he said, I agree with you. I want to do it too. Thank God. I didn't know what his politics were when I, because he was whacked out at Walter Reed. I mean, morphine, you couldn't talk to him. And when I finally went to Kansas City and met him, I noticed on the card table there, he had a bumper sticker that said draft Republican. And I thought, well, I have an anti-war warrior here.
Yeah.
And that was happenstance. I had no idea that's how it would turn out.
Yeah. Charlie Rangel has pointed out on this show more than once that not only do we not see the pain of war, but most Americans don't participate in the pain of war. And, you know, calling for a national draft, national public, you know, service program
right.
of some kind.
Right.
It seems that we have done such a good job over the last 20, 30 years of just making all this so remote. You know, we're not going to make that mistake we made in Vietnam again, mm-hmm. stirring up the young people.
Mm-hmm. And the language, you know, our soldiers don't die, they fall.
Right.
Harm's way. What a quaint euphemism. We have women who've had their faces blown off by IED. It's just amazing how everything conspires to war. You can't criticize it. It's not fair to the president.
Oh, there's money to be made. Norman Solomon is with us also. You are the co-founder of RootsAction.org, right?
Right.
You guys are sponsoring this tonight.
Yeah, last night we screened the film at a forum on war whistleblowing and independent journalism in Baltimore, and tonight, as you mentioned, at American University. I've seen the film Body of War about 6 times now, and when I watched it last night, by the end, I was in tears. And I think part of the reason for me and impact for a lot of other folks is that this is not only history. This is not only about a bogus debate 12 years ago. It's about the last few weeks. And you can just take a lot of the pro forma rote cliches from October of 2002 on the House and Senate floor. We were hearing them a couple of weeks ago for this next new war.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like it's being set up. I mean, it's actually there may be multiple ones. We're looking at Ukraine, we're looking at Syria, Libya's falling apart. What's going on in Iraq, Afghanistan? The list goes on and on. We're here with Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon. We'll be back in just a moment. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Time Line.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The movie is Body of War. It's showing tonight at American University here in Washington, D.C. You can contact American University for more information on it. Show up. We're on the line waiting. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon. Phil Donahue, what do you see as the really existential crises that this nation are facing right now?
Well, I'm flattered that you would value my answer. We've become a warrior nation. We have no respect for diplomacy. Norman has reminded me that we spend $2 billion a day on things that go boom. We are also in a place now where we're feeling very, very tentative about our own selves as a nation. We haven't won a war, if that's ever possible. And it's almost as though we'd rather win a war than avoid one. And the more I thought about this, I began to realize how the motivation for wars pile up. You don't get a statue in a park for fixing health care. You only get a statue in a park for war. Yeah. That's why we have horses and swords.
That's true.
Children play on cannons in parks.
Right.
And we don't seem to... You can't get elected unless you're tough.
This is Hillary's dilemma back in, you know, before the last election cycle.
We patronize Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
Peace. Oh, how nice.
Yeah, Department of Peace.
Also, we suffer from a cynicism. You know, nobody wants war, right, is what they say.
Right. There's always a but after that.
Let's be realistic. What's the matter with you? Okay. So the more you surrender to this inevitability, the more inevitable war becomes, especially if you're spending $2 billion a day on the stuff to fight it. And by the way, we're building billion-dollar aircraft carriers, and two guys with pressure cookers closed the city of Boston. 19 guys with box cutters brought us to our knees. And now the most cowardly instrument in the history of warfare, the drone. A guy sits in a padded chair. It probably leans back for comfort. Probably a coffee pot right over here. Looks at a screen. And there they are. We're killing children.
Yeah. Well, and the flip side of that is, and this I thought was one of the most underreported stories, is that among the drone pilots, and these are guys who are in a quiet room in Kansas someplace.
Yeah.
Among drone pilots, we're seeing suicide rates now and PTSD rates that are similar to those of people who've been in combat who have committed atrocities and come home and commit suicide.
Really?
So, I mean, it's like, you know, the war comes home. No matter how much we try to sanitize, how much we try to pretend it's a video game, it's not killing them. People get it. It's an amazing thing. No drones. Yeah. We'll be back with Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and in the studio with us, Norman Solomon and Phil Donahue. And Phil has produced this new film, Body of War, and it is playing tonight at American University, and you can also find it online, bodyofwar.com. And Norman Solomon with Roots Action.
.org.
And sponsoring the gig tonight at American University, and you guys are traveling around. Sean. Hang on just a second. There we go. Sean, in Lansing, Illinois, you had a question for Phil Donahue?
No, actually, it wasn't so much a question. I just wanted to give homage to all of you gentlemen in the room. You know, Phil, you got a raw deal at the TV station, man. I don't understand how they do these things, how they make these decisions. But you were one of the early ones against the war, and I think that affected you professionally. But what you guys are doing, and also hello, Norman. You guys are doing a wonderful job. Tom, as always, man, you're just amazing to me, man. I don't know why you don't run for office, man. We
Sean,
need a president like you, like Bernie.
Sean, thanks for your kind words, and thanks for the opening to a discussion about the media. Phil, you famously lost the number one rated show on MSNBC back when the Bush administration was ginning us up for war. How has, and we were in the first hour of our program, we had a couple of people on from the climate march in New York yesterday, which was not even mentioned on any of the network morning shows, was by and large ignored on the cable shows all day long. They were not showing, and this was in their backyard, literally 300,000, 400,000 people. And this morning, Morning Joe on MSNBC, the progressive network, although he's a conservative, never even mentioned it,
is that
to the best
right?
of my knowledge. Yeah, and this is what Media Matters is reporting and what I'm seeing in a number of reports. I'm wondering if all of these networks are making millions with these fracking ads, the wonders of fracking and clean coal ads, and BP is here for America and all that. What are your thoughts on the state of media today?
Well, the thing that has to be remembered first and discussed first is corporate media. There's a group out there titled Media Reform, Young People. And their banner says corporate media is ruining democracy. Hmm. When I was a reporter in Adrian, Michigan, 100 years ago, I had a Norelco tape recorder.
I started out in Lansing, Michigan.
Well, we must have covered the same murder at some time or another. I had a vacuum tubes in a Norelco tape recorder. And I was like 21. I must have looked 12. And I had my, the call letter WABJ on my microphone. And I could stop the mayor. Yeah. I couldn't get over how powerful I was. And I covered the births at City Hall and reported them, the births at M.L. Bixby Hospital. I played ball with the cops, for my sources.
Yeah.
Covered my first murder, covered City Hall. Today there is no WABJ. It was a proverbial 250-watt station. I didn't take a test to be a reporter. I didn't pee in a bottle. I just said, I'm a reporter. And I was. You want it that way because that way you get a lot of people reporting. And if you have a lot of people reporting, somewhere in the center of this large crowd will be found the truth. Today, that center is occupied by six multinational corporations, which are much more interested in the price of their stock than they are in chasing maybe investigative journalism, which often goes nowhere. And also, they don't want to rock the boat. Big media is the boat. I worked for MSNBC, which is owned by General Electric, and I was popping off about Rumsfeld, who's their biggest customer. So, I'm sure that the white Republican members of the GE board of directors had very little patience for this gray-haired daytime talk show host knocking our country at a time when everybody was waving the flag, as a consultant told my boss, who called me in and said, we just took a survey and most people don't like you. So I was.
Though you got the best ratings on the network?
Well, right. And also, that was a Republican consultant who made who created the
surprise
focus group that they took on me. We were not. We could not have two liberal. We had to have two conservatives for every liberal.
Right.
This is interesting because it tells you how terrified. This is. October 2002 was the date when I was on the air, one of the months, how terrified they were of opposing the war, of being thought of as liberal. We had to have two. They wanted me to do celebrities, and they didn't know what to do with me. I had already been hired, and they wondered why they had hired me. They didn't want to fire me. That's not a very good, that wouldn't necessarily flatter them. And so my producer would go down the hallway every morning, and they would look over our list. And the rule was I was considered two liberals. I mean, it seems silly now, but
yeah, Michael Moore was three liberals, wasn't he?
Probably.
I remember the story.
Right.
Yeah.
The most hated man in the White House was Michael Moore. I've told him how jealous I was that I didn't get that designation, but. It was truly and that Fox News belongs to a corporation that makes $1 billion a year profit. Think about that.
Wow. And is and their second largest stockholder is a Saudi. I mean, that's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know about in the coverage of Fox News of what's going on in the Middle East.
Right.
It's, I think it's 7% Prince Talaweed or whatever. Anyhow, we're here with Phil Donahue, Norman Solomon. We'll be back after this. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and it is 28 minutes past the hour. The movie is Body of War. Tonight, it's at American University. You can find that information over at Google American University or whatever. Give them a call, right? And rootsaction.org/DC as well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And bodyofwar.com. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide through the Free Speech TV Network. Pleased to have you with us, and pleased to have Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon in the studio with us. And they're here because tonight, here in Washington, D.C. at American University, and if you want to show up and see Phil Donahue and see Norman Solomon and watch this extraordinary movie, they're airing the documentary Body of War. The creator and host co-producer and co-director of this documentary is Phil Donahue, who's with us. And Norman Solomon's with us with RootsAction.org, which is one of the co-sponsors of this gig. So anything on the top of your heads you wanted to get to, or should we pick up some phone calls, or shall we see? Let's see where.
Very quickly,
yes, sir.
An extraordinary aspect of Body of War is it combines the human reality of what war does to so many people, the terrible destruction, and the political pollution of discourse on Capitol Hill. And usually people look at one or the other. Body of War combines it, and it's devastating.
Yeah. And hopefully fascinating and informative, because not everybody wants to show up to be devastated. So
very true. I mean, it's you can't, you know, we didn't want to preach. And I kept it to an hour and 17 minutes because that is the length of March of the Penguins. Yeah. And, I, you know, you can't ask them to take notes. It's very, this is not a take your girl to the movie movie.
Yeah.
And so that's why I hope. It's compelling, I believe, but I'm hardly your most objective witness. We'll let the people who show up tonight make that decision.
The movie is Body of War tonight at American University in Washington, D.C. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You have a question for Phil Donahue?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I admire you so much. I saw you speak when I was a kid back in the 80s in San Marcos, Texas. I'm sure you probably don't remember that, but I wanted to ask you a question about social media. I know you said back when you started out as a reporter that, you know, if you said you're a reporter, you could report, and the best or all kinds of stuff would come out of that. And now, you know, anybody can have a blog, or anybody with technology can be a reporter.
That is
so
true.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, it is a great, great hope. The media that you're watching me now on is the great hope for the future. We need media that is not, we need reporters who don't care if the White House calls them back.
Right.
We need programs like this that are not on a corporate nipple. We need media that comes from the ground up. We need media focused on people, not just the power elite. Today, elite media cover elite power. That's why you won't see Amy Goodman on Meet the Press or Dennis Kucinich. And that's why, you know, dissent is so difficult. It's so marginalized. It's not covered. Tom has already told me that the march yesterday in New York City on global warming was not covered. We're not interested in protesters. We want people who support America and are proud of America, and it's hurting this nation. We're standing mute as the Bill of Rights is being dismantled. I mean, my goodness, habeas corpus is gone. I mean, what's fundamental to you? You can have any kind of country you want. You know, we can get a Neo-Mussolini, and he'll tell us what's good for us, and we'll all, as we are now, stand mute and trust his judgment. Wow. The dissenters, the progressives, are the patriots. We believe in, we don't think you should listen in on a person's phone call without judicial authorization. We don't think a man should be in a cage for 14 years without any Red Cross phones from phone calls. We don't think a president should be able to decide who he's going to assassinate without even leaving the Oval Office. And then the unmanned aerial vehicle goes and fires him while he's sitting in the right front seat of an automobile 5,000 miles away. This is not making us safer. Their president's going to have to go to a church picnic in a Bradley armored vehicle. And we're all going to get naked to get on an airplane. And our children are going to wonder if they just got on the wrong bus or entered the wrong marathon. This is awful. We can't continue this. Imagine a drone fired from another country striking Ottumwa, Iowa. Imagine what this would do to us. I mean, everybody'd grab a stick and go after whatever. You think they're not responding the same way? We killed a wedding party. We bombed Grenada, for God's sake. Grenada. And hit a mental hospital doing it, by the way. It's a shame, really. And we have so much to sell. We have so much to be proud of. This is a fabulous constitution. Really, in the history of civilization, there's been no document as insightful as this, and worse, and it's crumpling away like an old parchment, and the American people are standing there watching it happen, mute.
Apropos of that First Amendment issue that Anita brought up, I have suggested for some time, you know, Dianne Feinstein is saying, let's protect journalists, in quotes, which means that now it's up to government to decide who is and who isn't a journalist. And I've been saying all along, we need to protect acts of journalism, regardless of who
does them. Well, that's the point I'm trying to make with my Adrian Michigan story.
Yeah.
You know, let's...
Well, I didn't go to J school either. I was a reporter for 7 years.
It's a crucial point. Only authoritarian to totalitarian governments try to license journalists. And there must be no licensing of journalists, or it becomes a tool of government.
Yeah, yeah. Let's pick up some more calls here. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You had a question for Phil?
Yeah, I just wanted to make the comment that... you know, we need media that has courage, and we have a lot of very spineless people in different media organizations. And even, you know, things that you used to rely on, like I used to listen to public radio. You know, a good example is the climate march in Manhattan. They made a mention of that there was a large march. They didn't even, you know, have the courage to say that there was between, which the Christian Science Monitor said was between 100,000 and 300,000 people. That's not a large march. That's huge. And it was one of the biggest in New York City in a long, long time.
John, your point?
Well, my point is that
You know, yeah, we just do, you know, there just is not the courage out there in these different media organizations because either they're too afraid or they're bought out, yeah. and even public
okay.
radio.
Let's get Phil and Norman's thoughts on this. It seems to me that when in 1982, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, and we saw this explosion of consolidation, these M&A artists, brand new job description on Wall Street, that now here we are 30, 35 years later, and every industry is dominated by between 3 and 7 companies.
Yes.
Every industry, including yeah. the media. That was one of the original sins.
I think so, too. And this point has to be made, Tom. I think all of us, myself most especially, have to be careful of barroom roundhouse generalizations. Mm. As regard to media, not everything sucks.
Yeah.
We have some real courageous stuff happening. To name one, and I've never met her, I don't know her, I don't know if she knows me. Arwa Damon for CNN has been in Iraq. She got the helmet, the flak jacket, and she has been telling us for several months now, Iraq is in chaos. You know, and isn't it interesting? Many of the reporters from these very dangerous places are women. Mm. And they are to be respected, and they should. I hope there's Pulitzers down the road for them. And so it's important to say that there's, in spite of corporate media and the bias toward rah-rah, we definitely have become a mouthpiece. You know what? Think about this for a second. Every major metropolitan newspaper in this country supported the invasion of Iraq. Every major metropolitan newspaper in this country. I've said that several times on public forums, and I am offering, if I've overlooked somebody from a major metropolitan city newspaper, I am prepared to apologize to them publicly. I haven't heard a word.
Amazing. Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon in the studio with us. The movie is Body of War. It's playing tonight at American University here in Washington, D.C. The website, bodyofwar.com, and, of course, rootsaction.org/DC. Norman, one of the co-sponsors. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
American University tonight at, what time is it? 6:30. 6:30 tonight at American University. Thank you. We'll be back. Okay. Garland in Cortland, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network.
Thank you for my call. Thank you.
Garland, you are on the air.
I like Phil Donahue and think he's held up very well, but I really don't agree with him on much of what he said, particularly the use of precision drones. But the question I had was, with us almost in a state of war, de facto, how can Congress in good conscience take such a break for elections when a lot of them either have no opposition at all or have no credible opposition? And the last thing is, on the timeline of the fall of the Roman Empire, where are we?
Interesting questions.
Yeah.
On the timeline, actually, I defer to Tom on that. He's such a great student of history. But, you know, Congress is so engaged in running for re-election 24-7, 365, that sometimes it's moot whether they're in Washington or not.
Yeah, I think we're, you know, if you've ever read Tacitus and Agricola, the history of the invasion of England that was written by the nephew, I think, or son-in-law of Caesar, and it was Thomas Jefferson's second favorite book. He wrote to his nephew, there are 3 books you must read, Paul de Ripon de Taurus's History of England, which was the Whig history, Tacitus and Agricola, and I forget the third one. I've read them.
Probably the Bible.
Yeah, and no, it wasn't, actually. But it's anyway, Phil, your thoughts on these issues?
Well, I wonder about, you know, if all good things must come to an end, and all good things will.
Hmm.
And we have to think about, are we so enamored with, you know, we're running around the last remaining superpower. Exceptionalism. And we're beginning to look, it's kind of unbecoming, really. I mean, if we're exceptional, and I believe our Constitution is, but it's largely being ignored now. If we're exceptional, it's, I think it's better if someone from another country says that about us. You know, the longer somebody says, I am not a crook, the more you begin to wonder. And the longer we brag about ourselves, like the bully in the playground, I am the toughest, I am the best. It's unbecoming, especially a nation of, you know, that is famous for its the security of its own liberties and what it guarantees its people through the Constitution is just fabulous. What we've done, how the Constitution protects the powerless against the tyranny of the majority, all those things make me a very proud American. But I have to say, this is in many ways not the nation that my parents taught me to pledge my allegiance to.
We have changed in so many ways over the last, well, hugely over the last 35 years. I mean, just the ravages of Reaganomics, the middle class being ripped apart, the insanity of war. Reagan thing. Well, let's have a nice little war. It worked for Maggie Thatcher,
yeah.
Right, in the Falklands.
Right.
Let's do the same thing in Grenada.
Right.
The only president that hasn't had a little war was Jimmy Carter. He was the only guy to have a war.
Well, he did try. Desert One was it? Remember the helicopter collided. But it's true. I agree. And he is largely marginalized now.
Yeah.
He's not at the top of our most.
Well, and I think to this question of, you know, Congress taking a 7-week vacation, I believe that this is part of the plan to marginalize Obama by not allowing him any legislative victories at all. They just leave town.
Right.
Anyway, we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom and Solomon and Phil Donahue with us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon with us. The movie is Body of War, bodyofwar.com. For more information on that, it's playing tonight, and Phil and Norman will be there at American University here in Washington, D.C. You can get more information also at rootsaction.org/DC. Phil, I'm curious. First of all, I got to tell you how intimidating it is to interview somebody who I have spent so many years watching you do these brilliant interviews. It's almost like sometimes you're reading people's minds. What was the moment in time, or was there one, when you went from being an entertainer or a reporter or a person in the media to being an activist?
Well, okay, I'm gonna give you a very brief. You're asking me to talk about myself. That's a dangerous thing to do to a talk show host. I put Madeline Murray O'Hare on my show for my first show because I knew she would draw a crowd, and we were in Dayton, Ohio, and there were no celebrities available to me. I couldn't do entertainment. I wanted to succeed. I wanted to get a.
She was the head of the atheists.
She banned. She got the Supremes to ban prayer in school. You shouldn't have a crucifix on the wall of a public school. We accept this now, but then it was. She was the most hated woman in America, and the building fell in. People, you know, there's no God, there's no heaven, there's no angels. I mean, it was, and everybody knew there was this program on in the morning. Our third program was a gay person, 1967. Wow. Nobody was out. And, of course, you know, I was scared to death. You know, people think I'm queer, which is what we called them when I went to high school. I went to high school with guys who wanted to beat up queers. I never wanted to beat up a queer, but I certainly didn't want to be with a queer. I mean, I went to Notre Dame, 16 years of education, Catholic. You know, you don't come out of that, you know, Catholics. The Christian church has done more to promote homophobia than most other institutions combined. And then we had another gay person on, and I began to, you know, your wheels start to turn. You know, why do I feel this way? What is homophobia? How did I get it? And why do I have it? And if they don't choose, and nobody wakes up at 13 years old and said, I think I'll drive Dad crazy. I'm going to be gay. And all these subjects made me start to think that the world that was shaped for me in the 50s, I came to age in the 50s. America was good in all things, Eisenhower, Lend-Lease, the Marshall Plan. And then suddenly in the late 60s, I'm having a professor on from Ohio State who's saying there isn't a professor at Ohio State who believes in this Vietnam War. And I couldn't believe it. And suddenly, are we going to lose a war? Are the Japanese taking over supremacy in automotive engineering? Somebody assassinated my president? And all this is happening. And I'm not in a sales program at a large retail company. I'm on the air with my name on it with all these newsmakers talking to me, actually feminists, you know. Kids get too much mother and not enough father. And I'm thinking, holy cow, they're talking about me. So it spun me. And suddenly I realized that I had Chomsky on, Noam Chomsky. I said, what are you trying to say? And he looked right at me and he said, never, ever trust the state. And what? I mean, I'm raised with, you know, America, World War II, Pearl Harbor, be proud. We defeated everybody. We defeated the Nazis. We got off the floor after Pearl Harbor. I wore a bell, a little badge, a little pin when I was six that said, remember Pearl Harbor. And then suddenly I realized that, hey, thousands and thousands of young men and women have gone to war to protect our way of life, at the center of which is free speech. And if you don't use it, you'll lose it. And that there's nothing unpatriotic about using it. Remember, you don't walk on water, but you have a right to be heard. And there is no democracy without dissent. And suddenly, in many, many ways, I found myself in the minority. But I was also hosting some programs we did some shows that, you know, after your haircut, you wouldn't leave the barbershop. You mm-hmm. wanted to see this.
Sure.
Compelling. Because that, our ratings went through the roof. So this was an all noble. This was a professional interest I had here.
Sure.
And we banged on a lot of doors, kicked a lot of big tires, a lot of sponsors canceled. But because we were in Dayton, you know, freedom is another word for nothing left to lose. We had no place to go but up. And a general manager who hung in, even though sponsors canceled. So in many ways, I was very, very lucky.
It was kind of the golden age of
talk radio.
Talk radio. And Alan Berg was still out there broadcasting out in the West Coast, or out in Denver, I guess it was. Before he got machine gunned down in the 70s, wasn't it?
So the late 70s. It was in the 60s. I'm sure it must have been the 70s.
Yeah, I think, and radio kind of went silent for a while, and then Limbaugh pops up in 87. Anyway, we're out of time. It is such an honor to have both of you guys with us today. Norman Solomon, RootsAction.org, Phil Donahue. Tonight we'll be at American University. RootsAction.org has the information. Also, the movie, of course, Body of War, bodyofwar.com. You can check it out. Phil Donahue, it's an honor to have you with us.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much
for dropping by today. And, Norman, it's always wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming by. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.